So it's my honor to introduce one of our rock star fleet new captains who's going to win Carol 1 for Pete on February 3rd, Dr. Kyle Newland.
Thank everybody for coming out. Thanks for people from Carroll. Thanks for people from outside of the Carroll County that's come in. We appreciate everybody being here. By the way, so Hannah gave a personal story of why she joined the campaign. I'd really like to recognize not just Hannah, but all the other young men and women who put their life on pause because they realized we need dramatically different leadership in Washington. The reason I decided to support Mayor Pete last fall was when you really dive deep and look at the issues, Mayor Pete recognizes as a Midwest mayor what rural development really means, what development in Iowa would mean. As far as our agriculture economy, it's not just farmers and their families that are dependent on an agriculture economy. Mayor Pete has been very clear that he supports the renewable fuel standard, that he will actively, as both the current administration, fight down the small refinery exemption abuse that's been going on. This is, in our area, pullet biorefining, the ag equipment industry, the co-op ag elevator industry. This is not just farmers and their families, which absolutely requires support, but it's all of our economies working together. Education. Did you know that if you were a rural teacher, even factoring in the cost of living benefit that you get in a rural area, you still on average make over $7,000 less than your urban counterparts. Mayor Pete is pushing for an increase in Title I federal funding to make up that gap between rural teachers and urban teachers. Hannah mentioned her partner in her family service. Mayor Pete served our country honorably as a naval officer. Western Iowa has a great tradition of sending our sons and daughters, brothers and sisters, parents, to serve our country in the military. And that gets rarer and rarer amongst our people seeking high office. That kind of service should not just be recognized, it should be commended. And finally, personally, what kind of sold me on this was demeanor. We in Iowa are very lucky. Not only can we get to witness all the national news, we get to see a lot of these candidates up close and personal. I've seen Mayor Pete on the debate stages, I've seen him in town halls, and we've gotten the chance. This isn't his first time in Carroll. He spent 4th of July with us. Not first time in Carroll. Mayor Pete has a calm strength. When he takes on tough questions, when he takes on rough members of a town hall or an audience, he responds candidly, he responds firmly, he responds with compassion and with maturity. And I think we can all agree that is sorely needed in the Oval Office. Some of you can be strong and still mature. So a week from Monday, you will find me at Carroll High as precinct captain in District 1 for Mayor Pete. Please find some of these wonderful campaign workers afterwards. Commit to caucus, commit to volunteer. If you just have more questions about the campaign, to ask them. But you're here to see somebody else. So I'm hoping that if I'm up here, that means I get to have the high privilege of introducing my and hopefully your choice for the next Democratic nominee for President of the United States, Pete Buttigieg.
That's going to deliver a win for us on February 3rd with your help. Thank you. Thank you to Hannah and everybody who's part of this campaign effort. I know I'm biased, but don't you think we have the nicest, most energized organizers and volunteers in the state of Maine? Thanks to all of you for joining us, for your patience as we were making our way here, and for caring enough about the future of this country to be here to talk about where this nomination is headed, where this presidency needs to go. I've been so moved from July 4th when we were in Carroll, and a lot of folks were coming to check us out and saying things like, how do I say your name again? And then a few months later, it was still, how do I say your name? But also, I knew we were getting somewhere, because people would say things like, you sound really good, you're in my top seven. And now I can tell that it's come to be decision time. So if you are a supporter of this campaign, I thank you. If you're making up your mind in these 9 days between now and the caucuses, I'm here to ask for your support. I'm here to explain why, the values that motivate this campaign. I'm here to share a couple of stories and talk about why I think the things I'm arguing for can't wait 4 years or 10 years. And I'm here for a conversation, so I'll try to say all of that quickly so we can talk about whatever's on your mind. Let me begin with the image that I always ask voters to visualize as crisply and specifically as possible. It's the controlling image of this campaign that I hold in my mind a lot. And so I'm asking you to form it in your mind, too. And it's what it's going to look like and what it's going to feel like the first time that the sun comes up over Carroll County and the rest of our country, and Donald Trump is no longer the president of the United States. First off, a reassuring reminder that one way or the other, that day will come. And that we can make sure that day comes sooner rather than later. And that when we do, we will be able to put this chaos and this corruption behind us. And won't that be nice?
Yeah.
To put the tweets behind us, won't that feel good? People are ready. But actually, the real reason I'm asking you to picture that day and to think about it is to think about what we're going to need on that day. Because the truth is, that's not the day our problems go away. It's really the day that our work begins. You can think about it. On that day, we're going to be exhausted from fighting. We are going to be divided and torn up over politics even more than we are now. And we're going to need to come together and unify around a common vision. Something else will be true at the very same time, which is that the issues that brought us to this point will only be more severe and critical by then. On that day, the sun will be coming up over a climate that is getting closer and closer to the point of no return. It'll be coming up over an economy where farm families are losing their livelihood, and people living in cities and towns are wondering when this great economy the president keeps talking about is going to make its way from the Dow Jones Industrial Average to our kitchen tables. Something's going to be coming up over schools where children are learning active shooter drills before they are old enough to learn how to read. That is what we will be facing and forced to confront on that day. And so we're going to need a president determined to unify the country and ready to do it in a way that moves us forward on these critical issues. And if it sounds like a tall order, it is. That's why we have the presidency. It's why the founders created the office. So I'm asking for your support based on the idea that the presidency has a purpose. And that the purpose of the presidency is not to glorify the president, is to empower and unify the American people to get these big things done together. That's what I'm asking for you today. And what I see is a powerful American majority ready to get those things done. An American majority for sure that's ready for a better president than the one we've got. But even bigger than the agreement on what it is that we got to change, what it is we're against, is an agreement, more than you would ever think from watching the news, an agreement on what it is we're for. And I am seeing Democrats, and I am seeing independents, And I'm meeting an awful lot of what I like to call future former Republicans. Ooh, perhaps there are some with us. And you are more than welcome to join this movement because we've all got to get this done together. Ready to bring about these changes. Insisting that we as a country do a better job of living up to our values. Not just because we believe in those values, but because of what it would mean in our everyday lives. And if there's one thing you learn, as the Iowa caucus process cuts this big national presidential campaign down the side and puts us in rooms together where we meet each other and hear each other's stories, it is an awareness of what is at stake, what we have to do and why. None of these things are theoretical. When we talk about grand issues of war and peace and the U.S. role in the rest of the world, that is personal for all of us, but especially for folks in the unit. Yesterday, I ran into a friend from my unit that I used to drill with in the military. He's getting ready to go to Iraq. And he deserves a president who would not ask anything of our service members if it were not necessary. Recently, and out of the campaign event, actually, by total coincidence, I was in an airport and I ran into someone I served with, hadn't seen in years, hadn't seen since we were both in Afghanistan. Matter of fact, I said hadn't seen her since she was injured in an insider attack while we were both serving in Afghanistan. And I saw her in the airport walking with her teenage son, wearing a t-shirt from the Wounded Warrior Project that said, "Some assembly required." And when I asked her how she was doing, she lifted up her leg, her knee, and tapped on the part where her prosthetic was. And said the Navy had fixed her up just fine, and she was looking forward to her next deployment. Because she is ready to do whatever the United States requires of her. That is why she deserves a President of the United States who regards our military with respect and will never send them into harm's way if it can be avoided. That's what's at stake in living up to our values at the point of the If our values be loving our country, if we got to recognize what that requires of us and the consequences if we fall short. That news we saw at a Clive not long ago where a woman was driving her car and saw a 12-year-old black boy and a 14-year-old Latina girl and thought to herself, I'm going to hurt them because they're different. We got to remember that what love of country requires of us, among other things, is the knowledge that our country consists of people. That we got to stand up for each other because you cannot love a country if you hate half of the people in it. The only thing that doesn't belong in the United States of America is that kind of hatred. And that's what this state is about. When I think about health care, I don't think that's theoretical for any of us. Because far too many of us have been in a situation that asks us to scratch our heads and wonder how it is that the United States of America handles healthcare the way we did. I just met a woman just at the event before we came here. We were in, that's such a blur, we were at Buena Vista County. And she was sharing that a family member of hers has been diagnosed with terminal cancer. And in order to get healthcare for the family, it's going to qualify for Medicare, but it takes a 2-year waiting period to get that. And they're not sure that he's got that much time. And so in the meantime, during what might be unbelievably precious days to spend with his family, he's got to continue going into work just to be able to get the care. That's why the time has come for us to deliver Medicare for all who want it. We're dealing with as a country reflected in the stories of the people I meet, I see the solutions there too. I see the values that could knit us together, often in the stories of people I run into who are not even old enough to vote. Just ran into someone today who I had first met a few days ago in Emmitsburg, who stuck up her hand at an event like this to share a story about what had happened to her family. Her question was about immigration. It was about what was going on at the border. The reason she asked that question was not because she was necessarily a an immigration policy buff or had been anywhere near the border, but because a few years earlier, her family had been devastated when her father walked away. And so she knows exactly what happens when a family is separated. She knows what family separation meant to her. And was able, in that pain that her family went through, to find the moral imagination to put herself in the shoes of someone who, on the surface, was nothing like her. A five-year-old Salvadoran boy, let's say, at the Texas border, separated from his family. And if she can have that level of moral imagination and compassion, surely the rest of us can deliver a political system that does a better job of reflecting that moral intelligence and doing right, not only by our laws, but by our values as a country. This is our chance. This is our only chance to defeat Donald Trump. And if we do it big enough, to send Trumpism into the history books as well. To have shockwaves so forceful that they can even accomplish the feat of reuniting Senate Republicans with their conscience. That could happen. If we come right now and send that message. But that means we've got to make sure we go into this election with an insistence that we're going to turn the page. Not just recycling the same political warfare, the same political arguments that brought us to this point, but really being ready to do something different. In other words, we can't listen to the voices that are telling us we got to choose between listening to our heads and listening to our heart. We got to choose between unity and boldness. We got to choose between winning and governing. The only way to get one of those things right is to get all of those things right. And we have a chance to do exactly that. And Iowa has a knack for creating historic opportunities for people with big, bold ideas running for president of the United States. So, that's why I'm here asking for your support. That's what I think we can achieve together. But again, I know you waited a long time to come in here, so I'm going to cut the monologue right there, and want us to have a conversation as much as time allows. We got mic runners, give a quick wave. We got one of those mics. The microphone will come to you. They'll hold it for you and everything. And let's talk about whatever's on your mind. Isn't it?
Hi. So, I just wanted to say, I have a formerly very successful brother who's currently in jail on multiple charges, which stem back to mental health and a single prescription for Adderall. I have a son who's going to be 18 in a few months and who will have to find his own insurance. And as a pharmacy employee, I've personally watched people not get critical medications due to high costs. I don't believe that GoFundMe should be our primary healthcare funding system.
Awesome.
Everyone has a big picture solution, but as president, what do you feel is the most broken part of our healthcare system, and what is the first feasible thing that you'll do to tackle that?
Well, first of all, thanks for speaking up, not only for your loved ones, but for the patients that you see in your work. And you're right, this is no way to operate in the United States of America. And we're having this big argument over Medicare for All or Medicare for All Who Want It or something else, right? Arguing over whose plan is best. Of course, I think my plan is the best. But there's a lot more to what's at stake in healthcare right now than how we're going to get coverage. We've got to act on, for example, prescription drug affordability, like you're talking about. And that's very specific and concrete and actionable. Here's what we can do about it. First of all, allow Medicare to actually negotiate the price of drugs. And this is a no-brainer. And also, we'll do it in that public plan that I propose that we create. Another thing we've got to do is hold drug companies accountable when they are jacking prices up through the roof, not because they have to. I mean, I understand if there were some rare ingredient and there was a shortage of it. They were forced to raise prices. But what we're seeing right now is companies doing this not because they have to, but because they can. And that's where we've got to have some enforcement on that kind of price gouging. When I'm president, we would. Now, another thing that I think is very important and gets overlooked is when we're talking about out-of-pocket medical expenses. A lot of, even if you have insurance, a lot of folks have insurance that gives you a cap every year. Maybe you've been in this situation. I'm sure you've seen patients in this situation. They're holding off to get it on the right date. Not because it's the right thing medically for them, but because that's when their cap kicks in. It's why I'm proposing that we not only have an out-of-pocket cap, it's a lot lower. I'm proposing $250, unless if you're unable to afford medication. But also that we do it monthly, not yearly. Because most of us don't experience the economy yearly, right? The bills come in every month for most of us. So that's how the cap should be set up. My point is, we take a bunch of specific actions around that. Now, you also raised the concerns and the challenges of addiction and mental health. And unfortunately, part of the problem right now is the criminalization of addiction and mental health issues. We have got to move past that as a country. And we've got to recognize that addiction is a medical, not moral, problem. And lives are on the line in getting this right. And that means everything from making sure we have more mental health providers, especially in rural areas where we don't have nearly enough, making sure the reimbursements are set up to encourage people to go into the field to begin with, making sure that the pay is comparable. But also, behind all of those reforms that I think have to happen policy-wise is something that has to happen in our culture. And that's being ready to talk about it, like you just did. It's got to be as okay to talk about an addiction struggle as it is to talk about a struggle with cancer. We've got to make it as normal to talk about a serious mental illness like bipolar disorder as we would getting ready to have a knee surgery. Because these are medical issues. And if we can break that silence, in fact, let's just, because I think it's worth doing this. If you or someone you love or someone you work with has been affected by a serious mental illness or an addiction issue, just go ahead. Let's do a quick show of hands. Just about everybody. So we can stop talking about this. Like, this is just something that off in the corner that only affects a handful of people. It's affecting every family, every workplace, and every community. And as president, I will be committed not only to drive the right kind of policies, but to give voice to these challenges so folks realize that it's okay to talk about their struggles. And thank you for doing exactly that. Yes?
Coming. As a woman of faith living in a community of faith, it's important how our faith guides us in our decisions. And I, for one, am up to here being portrayed as if I'm a Democrat, I must be anti-Christ or something. And I know that your faith colors your moral values. And could you speak to that for a moment?
For sure. And thanks for raising that. Our party's been allergic to talking about faith. And I think it comes from a good place, which is that we respect the separation of church and state. We know how important it is that the Constitution and the country belongs to people of every religion and of no religion equally. But we shouldn't be afraid to talk about where faith leads us. I've sometimes heard the campaign process described as an MRI of the soul. And so I want to be transparent about how I'm formed. And when it comes to what's going on in our politics, you know, we see this president trying to recruit faith as though it means you got to be on his side. This president, I mean, I'm at a loss for words. And everybody can have their own conclusions about where their faith tradition leads them. But I got to tell you, I belong to a faith tradition that says an awful lot about the Christian obligation to look after the marginalized. That salvation has to do in part with how you make yourself useful to the oppressed. When I think about the calling and the teaching of ideas and words like, I was hungry and you fed me. I was a stranger and you welcomed me. This does in fact have implications for how we treat each other in public. And I think that we should not be afraid to talk about these ideas, that come to us from our faith traditions, all the way down to the golden rule, which every faith and non-religious moral tradition I've ever seen embraces. You got to treat other people the way you want them to treat you, and ask whether that has implications for what we're doing in our policy choices. And if we did, I think that we could find this to be a gentler place to live in, even as we continue to insist that God does not belong to a political party in the United States of America.
Thank you.
still mayor for Fred, Iowa. Thanks so much for your support.
Good to see you again, Mayor Pete. Recently, you rolled out your infrastructure plan, and one of the things that really stood out to me coming from a rural community was the comments you made on rural water quality, and especially the rising water bill because of that. So in my community from Frick, we have a $7.5 million water treatment plant that we have to start building, and in 5 years, we have to start a $13 million wastewater treatment plant, and what that translates to is our resident bills double. So you mentioned kind of assistance along the line of grant opportunities as potential. Could you speak to that a little bit? Because I know many of us in this room have had the exact same thing happen, and if communities haven't done it, they're going to be doing it.
That's right. Yeah. I'm always hoping somebody will ask me a water and wastewater question. It almost never happens, so it's fitting that it came from a fellow mayor. But this is important. Look, when we hear infrastructure, usually we're thinking about the flashier stuff. We're thinking about bullet trains and superhighways, as well as the basics, roads and bridges. But some of the most important infrastructure in the country is underground. It's water and wastewater and the plants that support it. And it's one of those things that I think is designed so you don't have to think about it. Right? I mean, your life just goes a little bit better if when you get up in the morning, you can count on a glass of clean, safe drinking water coming out of the tap and don't have to give it another thought. If you did have to give it thought, that would diminish your freedom for the rest of the day. And yet, we're finding a lot of folks can't count on it. So we have a quality issue affecting a lot of communities. And we've got federal standards that insist on improving quality. Now that's great, but how are communities supposed to do it? Right now there's not much of an answer. And so it falls on communities to pass the cost of that onto their residents, many of whom are low income, who are spending a shockingly high proportion of their income just paying the water bill. And it's going to increase with some of the things that we need to do for the Clean Water Act and sewer separation. So let me make a confession. This might be the number one area where the current president actually had me fooled a little bit. Because there was a lot of talk about infrastructure when this president came in. And I actually thought he might do it. I didn't support him, but I thought he might do it. Because it's popular on both sides of the aisle. We clearly need it. It's good for the economy. So well, maybe they deliver on that one. And then they rolled out their infrastructure plan, and their plan was for cities and towns to do all the work, which is how it already is. So this time, we've got to make sure we're actually putting our federal money where our mouth is. Yes, we have state revolving fund programs. That's good for helping with the interest cost, but it doesn't really get to the actual cost of the project. And so when I'm talking about investing $1 trillion in the future of this country through infrastructure, part of that has to be in a fund that is available to communities, especially rural communities, that face a lot of challenges to begin with, to help manage the cost of these kinds of upgrades. We cannot improve quality in a way that makes cost of living out of reach, or else we're not going to be able to actually solve the problem. And we already have so much work to do to make sure folks can live and thrive in rural communities. Making sure we build up healthcare resources, making sure we build up quality of place, making sure we build up our economies and get them online, which is why broadband is another part of what we've got to do, because some of the infrastructure is digital. But we've got to make sure that we take care of the resources. And yes, we've got to have a hand, not just in standards, but in dollars to do it with. So thanks for what you're doing today. Make sure you're doing it. So I feel pretty strongly about this because I'm married to an arts educator. I don't think I'd be welcome at home if I weren't strongly in favor of arts education. But I also think this is actually important for some of the same reasons that Seth is important. Part of why we need to make sure that we're doing a great job educating kids on science, technology, engineering, math, is because we know how important technology is going to be to succeed in the future. Right? They're calling it the new machine age because so many of the things that are today done by people are being done by machines in the future. But that doesn't mean that human activity goes away. It means that we need to be ready for the things that a machine can never do. So part of it is we've got to be good at dealing with machines. That's where the tech and the science comes in.
But think about it. What are things that a machine can't do? Right? Things that we repeat all the time are going to be increasingly done by a machine. Whether you're a fast food worker, or a checker, at Target, or Walmart, or a radiologist. I mean, some of these are high paying jobs. But there are things that a machine can't do, like dealing with surprises, quality control, dealing with ambiguity, dealing with other people. Machines can't do that. At least not well. And so a big part of what I think is actually going to become more important in this high-tech future we're living in are social and emotional skills. And the ability to relate to others, building compassion, building empathy. And these are things that arts and humanities education are uniquely able to help us get done. They create that empathy. Educating future workers, we're educating future citizens and parents and neighbors and voters. It's all the more important to realize that for that reason, civics and arts and humanities education, they're not a luxury, they are a necessity for us to be able to advance in society. And I listen to that.
Training where they shot track pistols in the hallways so we knew what gunfire sounded like in our hallways. You already addressed mental health care, but what are you going to do to help make schools safe for the students and people that work there?
So, you shouldn't have to worry about this as a teacher. We're already asking way too much of teachers. like you said, you're on the front lines of mental health, because our system's got too many gaps, and so it falls on teachers and first responders, largely, to fill in. And now, you know, some folks seem to think that teachers are going to be able to turn into highly trained armed guards when there's a threat to a school, right? As if that's what you signed up for. And when I think about, you know, training in simulations like that, it makes me think of my military training. And part of why I felt I was serving in uniform was to learn about and deal with things like that so that you never would have to. And here we are. And so the solutions largely lie in our common sense need to have gun policies that make our communities safer. And this is not only something that Democrats are about. You know, 80% or more of Republicans think we ought to at least be doing background. Red flag law, where somebody who's identified to be a danger by loved ones often can be disarmed. Being able to disarm domestic abusers and somebody who poses a threat to a school. And when it comes to the kind of weaponry that's out there, the kind of weapon, anything remotely resembling what I trained on and carried in a war zone, has no business being sold for profit anywhere near the school where you're at.
The president's got authority to do what he needed to do to keep the people safe.
But we're supposed to work with Congress without regard to party whenever possible. And we're not seeing that at all. We see the judiciary turning into one more political partisan battleground. It's one of the reasons why I think we need to be ready for structural reforms to make the court, the Supreme Court, less politicized. And the role of Congress has become more and more problematic because, largely because people in, it's not just the president going around Congress, it's folks in Congress deciding to put party over country. I don't think you have to belong to one party to believe that there need to be some limits on presidential mandate. And most of those limits that we really counted on, it turned out they were coming from presidents themselves. In other words, I don't think we realized until now how much we relied on presidents to just not do certain stuff and not say certain things and not tweet certain things, right? The founder didn't have that kind of So part of this is making sure Congress is set up in a way that is more responsive to the American people. Right now, you see a lot of folks who are only responding to the dictates of the president's party. Well, this is one of the reasons why we need to reform districts in this country. Iowa, by the way, has a great head start on this. Now the rest of the country needs to move to get away from these districts, drawn basically by politicians picking up their voters instead of the other way around. And so they're less and less accountable to us, and they're more and more just responsive to the politics. So that's something that would make a difference. But some of it, frankly, is presidential restraint. And that's the kind of president I'll be. For example, when it comes to war powers, if I really do, and I hope I never do, but if the situation ever arises where I need to seek an authorization to use military force, I'll put a built-in 3-year expiration date on that. That if there was ever a need to do more, you'd have to go back to Congress and convince Congress, speaking on behalf of the American people, that that's the right thing to do. Because we have service members who can summon the courage to go into harm's way. We ought to make sure that our members of Congress have the courage to take up or down votes on whether they ought to go there. So these are the kinds of changes we can make to the way the branches of government interact to make it more balanced. And if you're like me, then watching this impeachment process is exhausting. It's demoralizing, right? I mean, I live and breathe politics, and I find it exhausting. It makes me want to change the channel and watch cartoons. But that's how we win, is to refuse to walk away. How they win, how the cynics win, is if they get us to switch it off and just say, the whole thing is end one, right? And the beauty of 2020, the good and bad fortune that we have being alive as voters in the year 2020, is that we don't have to be at the mercy of these politicians and wondering whether they're finally going to do the right thing. We have hiring and firing power over those votes. And this is our chance to send a totally different message and say, no, you can't get away with that. No one's above the law. And if the Senate's not going to do the job of sending that message, we will. And this is our chance right now. Representing a new generation, calling the country to its highest values, and hadn't been in Washington for very long, if at all. So I think that the greatest risk we could take is to turn to the same mindset that got us here and expect a better result. This is our chance to realize that winning well and governing well actually are the same thing. If you get it right, good policy will be good politics, and good leadership will help us improve the politics and policy of this country so that we can actually be proud of it. Because it's hard to feel proud of anything related to our politics right now, right? But we should. Our democracy is what defines this country. Our country isn't defined by the same kinds of things that other countries are. It's a set of values, and it's a process that we follow. That's what makes America, America. And that's what we are the protectors of. you in particular, as I always, with that famous thumb on the scale that the process gives you. And I've seen how seriously you take that influence that you have as you contemplate how to use it on the night of the Iowa caucus. So I'm here because of my belief that Iowa is poised once again to do something historic. I was here as a volunteer, knocking on doors, in 2008 when Iowa let the country know that it was okay to be inspired and to follow a candidate calling our country to do something we're sure we could do. It was also Iowa that made it possible for folks like me to have a wedding ring like this for the first time. So what I'm asking for is, are you ready to make history one more time with us on February 11th? Thank you.